Welcome to the Dialogue by Wirepoints, connecting the dots between our economy, government, and people. And now your hosts, Ted Dabrowski and Mark Glennon.
Mark Glennon here. Welcome to the Dialogue by Wirepoints. I'm here with my partner, Ted Dabrowski. We'll try to tackle some of the big stories that are happening in Illinois. They really actually overlap with a lot of federal stories, which is increasingly true. And we'll start with what is really clobbering the working class, which is inflation, particularly gasoline prices. They're up to a record high in Illinois, average of $5.30 for regular, size $6.27 in Chicago right now. I mean, imagine if you're a trade person driving a pickup or a van, that's just devastating. And ordinary people commuting long distances, they just don't have that kind of spare change in their budgets to handle this stuff, not to mention all the other prices increases that are going on. But Ted, well, first of all, what makes it particularly infuriating for those of us who are old enough to remember the 1970s is, you know, we went through this damn problem in the 1970s. The country was rocked by high oil prices that riddled through the rest of the economy, crippled the country. The lesson was clear that we had to move towards independence in energy. We had that as recently as 2 years ago when we threw it away. But part of the problem we'll go to first is the tax structure on this. Ted, you had a very educational piece up about this that I confess that I was not fully aware of all the elements of it. So let's kind of run through what the government is doing at the state and federal level. Tell us what you found, what you detailed in that piece about the elements of the what ends up in the gasoline tax, Ted.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. And before I do that, let me just a little bit of what do you want to call it? Background, because it's fascinating right now. So I'm looking at the AAA. AAA has a gas price, and they have a map, and they color code it, and they have the average prices across the country, and then of course the average price in each state. You know, they're tracking it day to day, so you can see what's happening. And you know, the first fascinating fact is that we in Illinois have the highest gas prices east of the Rockies. So of course out west you got these high gas prices going crazy over there, but once you cross over the Rockies, well, we're the outliers. Our average price is $5.32 right now. So that's point number one. The other fascinating point is that if you go right over the border to Missouri, so we're at $5.32, right over the border in Missouri, it's $4.36. So it's a dollar, whatever it is, 96 cents or whatever it is, 96 cents cheaper on average per gallon in Missouri. Again, what the heck is that? You go right over the border to Wisconsin, it's not even $4.70. So you're talking about 60 something cents cheaper. It's just fascinating that we in Illinois could be so much more expensive. What makes us different? What makes us special? And I'll tell you one of the things. One of the things is taxes, and that's what you're talking about, Mark, is the gas taxes we pay in Illinois. Another, which I know less about, is the rules, the environmental rules that require us to have different blends. And I know in Chicago, you have to have a higher blend, and so it's more expensive. So that drives up the prices too. But gas taxes is the one we want to talk about, because that's the one that's, you know, again, a state controlled and local government controlled thing where the gas taxes just keep going up. We are the second highest in the country. So let's peel back the onions, and that's what we try to do. So the first thing you have to know is that, you know, everybody, every state in the country charges 18 cents for the federal motor fuel tax. So you're always going to have that 18 cent base on your tax bill or in your embedded in your gas prices. But then in Illinois, for example, we do another thing. We also have a state motor fuel tax. So 18 cents is the federal. And before 2019, we had a 19 cent motor fuel tax at the state level. Well, Governor Pritzker and the people who supported his capital plan, they doubled it to 38 cents. So now add 38 cents to your base cost of gas. And they also have indexed it to inflation so that each year that 38 cents is growing by inflation. So that thing will always continue to grow. Add on to that, something that's rare in the country, about 10 states have it, is a state sales tax. So the sales tax is 6.25%. So this is the one that's, I think, the most insidious, because as gas prices go up, your tax goes up because it's a sales tax. It's a percentage, 6.25%. Well, at the levels back at the end of the month in May, when we did this just a few days ago, the sales tax adds another 27 cents. And as gas prices get closer to $6, it'll be 33 cents. So it's a up. Add to that a 1 cent state fee. We won't talk about that one. Then when you consider a place like Naperville, well, state laws allow now counties and local governments to raise their taxes on that. So you have a motor fuel tax of 8 cents put on by the DuPage County. And then Naperville puts on its own 4 cent tax on top of that. So in a place like Naperville, you're paying 98 cents on top of what was then about, $4 of base cost. So it's a 25% tax that pushes the gas prices up over $5. And that's, you don't see that in other states, right? We're the second highest in the country right now with these income taxes, these gas taxes. And it's just a layer after layer after layer.
So Ted, to be clear, taxes aren't the only thing running up prices, and they're not all caused by government. The war in Ukraine obviously is contributing mightily to it as well. The spending by the federal government, however, is contributing generally to inflation. The ridiculous $10 trillion that was dumped on the economy, including $5 billion of funny money created by the Fed, has driven up all prices, and that's contributing to inflation generally. And also, and this is what really worries me in the long term, is the effect this may have on electricity production. And this got very little press.
Hey, Mark, can I just jump in before you go there?
Sure.
Yeah, let me just add a couple things just before we change that. We also, and there's a lot of people who live in Chicago, right? And when you look at that, then there's also sales taxes put on by Chicago and Cook County. And so you start adding more layers instead of that 6.25% sales tax, which is the state sales tax. Then you've also got, for example, in Chicago, you pay a Chicago sales tax of 1.25%. So in Chicago, that adds 6 cents to the bill. Then there's a Cook County sales tax, 1.75%. That adds on 8 cents. Cook County also puts on its own motor fuel tax. That's another 6 cents. And I'm going to keep going one more. The Regional Transit Authority, which is what runs the Metra and CTA and all that, they put on their own 1.25% sales tax. So that's another 6 cents. So you can see, like you said, Mark, that the problems of inflation were bad enough. The problems of Russia and Ukraine were bad enough. But what's happening is those problems worsen. The sales taxes in Illinois keep pushing the gas taxes. So it's pain on top of pain. And I just want to make sure that was clear. And so in Chicago, for example, you're talking about over $1.20 of tax out of your total tax bill, out of your total gas bill.
Yeah. Thanks for adding that in. Where this may become a broader problem is in energy production. And this has not gotten much attention, but last week, a number of reports came out warning about blackouts across much of the nation, potentially possible rolling blackouts in electricity, because we simply don't have the electricity production anymore that's expected to keep up with demand. Illinois and much of the upper Midwest is in one of those warning zones, and Southern Illinois in particular is in one of those zones. Why? Because in the new energy bill that Illinois recently passed, CEJA, they screwed up on the timing and impact of the closure of coal plants, which largely fuel electricity production in Southern Illinois. So those are closing down at a faster rate than was anticipated. And again, the risk is that they simply won't have the production capacity to meet demand. Again, this is not my conclusion. This is from a number of reports, one of them being from the North American Electric Reliability Corp. It's a regulatory authority that monitors the risk to the grid. And the high-risk areas include Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, and as I say, in particular, of Southern Illinois, fundamentally, it's because we have placed too much reliance on the production of renewables. We're not against renewables here. They're part of the solution. But if you over-rely on them and you become overly dependent on them and they can't produce, then you're going to have a problem. And we've done that, and we've launched a war on fossil fuels that's been particularly evident under the Biden administration. You simply can't produce enough. And by the way, my conclusion that the renewables can't keep up with it comes from the federal government. We're going to be writing a separate article about that, about their data to that effect. And you have to wonder about the rationale behind some of the people that have sponsored the war on fossil fuels. It's been pretty clear that some of them, between the lines, some of them expressly, like high oil prices because they think it'll kill off demand for fossil fuels and push people more quickly into renewables, electric vehicles, and so forth. Jen Psaki, the former White House spokesperson, said just that when the gas prices were creeping up. She said, buy an EV. That's the solution. Well, a lot of people don't have the money to buy an EV. And of course, if you're buying it, you're going to be reliant on that power grid that's now in danger as well. So this is a very scary time. And as I say, it's so maddening to see this taking place once again, having lived through it in the 1970s.
Well, yeah, Mark, it's maddening to see it happening. It's going to be even more maddening if and when it does happen. I don't think that people, I think it'll wake up a lot of, especially Southern Illinois, who have disliked these policies, but it may come to life. And it's election time, and I think everybody needs to know what are good policies and what are bad policies. And some people, like you said, want green all the way at any cost. And so if they like that, then Pritzker has been their person. But Pritzker needs to be held accountable, or he can embrace his plan. But he's been one of the nation's biggest supporters of the green energy movement. And he and Harman and others made a special trip to the United Nations Climate Change Conference. And Governor Pritzker touted Illinois' quote leadership role by establishing a nation leading climate action plan, and that Illinois was quote the leading the Midwest on climate action and building a green energy economy. So he has been championing it. He also said that Illinois last year championed the most aggressive, most progressive climate bill in the nation. And his plan to have 50% of electricity production from renewable sources by 2040 and 100% by 2050. Well, he owns this. And if it works out beautifully, then he owns it. If we have brownouts, he owns that as well. And so I think this is a moment to really look at this local policy, how it ties into the national policy. But people need to be held accountable for what's happening.
And the state and local people have a big influence on national policy. Let's not forget that. And what's frustrating is that the press never questions them about this. They get free rein to get publicized when they selectively choose something where they're making a criticism or a suggestion to the federal government that they think will sell well. For example, Pritzker has testified twice before Congress about his prowess in controlling COVID. And during the Trump administration, of course, he had daily press conference basically about COVID, which were haranguing the Trump administration about its failures on that. But are they ever asked, are you supporting Biden's energy policy? What have you told him about this? What are you trying to fix? No one ever asked Pritzker or anybody else, even in the congressional delegation, about that. It's a real failure by the press, in my view.
Yeah, and Mark, I think I mentioned this, a podcast or two ago about a plan. And like you say, I've never heard the media ask Pritzker for his real plan. If you really have such an ambitious goal to dramatically change how electricity is produced in this state, then you better have, I think, just the most awesome, well-structured plan to do so, because we're not quite sure where all that capacity is going to come from. If you kill the old production and you don't have a plan for the new production, then how are you going to get there? And the media should have just really challenged him on it. And I mentioned that we FOIA'd the Pritzker administration. We never got anything. We got a couple PDFs of stuff, but it wasn't a plan. It certainly wasn't a plan that tells you how you do this massive transformation from one source of electricity to another.
Ted, we were joking before the podcast about trying to come up with positive things to say. It's, it's no easy feat to try to come up with positive things to say on this. All I can say is that the weather right now and the prediction for a few days, it's going to be cool, windy, and sunny.
A beautiful day this morning. Yeah, there you go.
That'll keep the power going for now.
And Mark, to that point, you look at states like, again, we can talk about Florida. We've talked about their recent out-migration gains, all those people moving there. You talk about them taking on the system, whether it's, keeping schools open during COVID or whatever it is. There's a lot of positive things there. We just don't live in that state right now. We're in the state that does the opposite of what all the growing states. And, a lot of the work we've done looking at red states versus blue states, if you want to look at it that way, they're all growing. We're all shrinking. And a lot of that has to do with policy.
Let's talk about some other changes in Illinois that, of course, are being ignored by the press. Ted, first, it's worth mentioning what we talked about last week, that your superb report on the IRS data on people moving, where taxpayers and their dependents are moving, got a lot of national attention. Your story was either reprinted or linked in a number of national journals. It really ran up our page views on it and theirs. Not a word. In the Illinois press still, as we mentioned last week, only the News Gazette down in Champaign and Center Square have run those numbers, which run directly counter to the population direction that the Democrats are claiming in Illinois.
Yeah, it's fascinating. These are hard numbers. These are like straight from tax returns. It's not like some survey, some probabilities, some percentages. This is very hard, concrete data. And the fact that not a single or hardly anybody in Illinois wanted to cover it, it just doesn't suit. Bottom line is, I don't think they want to be called carnival barkers by Governor Pritzker. That's the only thing I can think of, because it's pretty big news. And, it's huge news outside of the country, outside of the state. It's huge news in Florida, where they were picking up people. It was picked up a lot in New York. One of the articles we wrote highlighted how New York was in the worst shape, worse than Illinois, the only other state worse than Illinois. And people wrote about it a lot. But
Ted, speaking of New York and Illinois, that leads to another two reports that came out, once again, entirely ignored by the Illinois press. And they go to the notion of whether Illinois is a net giver or donor state versus a net taker. Now, if you've been around in Illinois, this is like conventional wisdom for decades. I remember hearing about this as a kid, that, Illinois gets cheated because it sends far more to the federal government in taxes than it gets back, because there are military bases in Texas and things like that, that a lot more money flows to other states than here. And routinely we hear that from Illinois politicians. Don Harmon, when he made his infamous claim that Illinois needed a $40 billion bailout, he cited that. Comptroller Susana Mendoza uses that claim all the time for various requests for things that Illinois wants, or excuses for Illinois' failures. Pritzker has made the same claim. And it has been true in past decades that Illinois was a big giver. But two things. Number one, it really never meant much, because it was really just a reflection of the fact that we have progressive federal income taxes. So New York and Illinois were net givers because they had more wealthy people there. And so it's particularly hypocritical for progressives to be complaining about the result those states are paying more over to Washington. That's the natural result of progressive income taxes, and they ought to be cheering it instead of trying to get it clawed back and taken back on the grounds that it's unfair. But now, in the last 2 years, it's become clear also that Illinois, it turns out, is not a net taker. It's a net giver. And no doubt it's tied to exactly what you wrote about in that that with that data from the IRS, Ted, that said that not only that we're losing taxpayers, but that people moving in have lower incomes than people that are moving out. So the two biggest studies, only two regular studies, really the only two that are out there, come out every year. One is from the Rockefeller Institute in New York. As I say, New York has been a constant complainer about this as well. And the New York Comptroller. Both of them this year show Illinois as a net taker. Now, this is for 2020. Those are the most recent numbers. 2020 was a very unusual year, unique actually, because all that federal money dumped into all the states made every state a net taker. But still, if you look at the numbers, first of all, in the Rockefeller study, they adjusted, took out the COVID money. Illinois was still a net taker. Secondly, ranked by states, Illinois ticked up in terms of how big a taker it was. Only a small increase, would move from 41 to 43, I think it was. It moved up nevertheless. So that's now 2 years in a row that Illinois has been shown to be a net taker by these studies. And nevertheless, you know, when these politicians make these claims otherwise, they get printed, they don't get challenged. The press is ignored, the studies to the contrary. It's just another chapter in the picture of how Illinois is changing. You know, our fundamental case, Ted, has always been that Illinois needs to be restored to a competitive position, at least in order to fix its financial mess and a return to stability. It needs economic growth like the other states are having. It's not happening. We're declining compared to other states. Our competitive position is worsening. This is just another piece of evidence on that.
That's right, Mark. And I, you know, just to kind of bring tie back together to those IRS migration numbers, the Florida numbers are fascinating, right? They've been winning people and the let's call it the income that they bring with them for years, year after year after year. Florida, if you just look at 2019, the 2020 numbers, they gained 3.3% of their previous year's AGI. In other words, their whole taxable base, just by grabbing people from other states, grew by 3.3%. That's not trivial. And if you do that year after year after year, like they've done, they're, like you said, they're growing their tax base, which takes a lot of pressure off of them when they're trying to do their budgets. You know, in the case of Illinois, we lost 2%, 1.9%, almost 2% of our tax base, or I should say 1.9% of our AGI walked out the door, gone. New York, 2.5%. These are huge numbers. You know, one year sounds like not that big a deal. All right, you lose 2%. But when you do that 20 years in a row, like Illinois and New York have done, that's a massive impact to your position. And then, of course, like you say, that impacts whether you're a giver or a taker to the federal government, because, you know, as you lose people and you're more expensive people, well, you're going to have more transfers come in as the federal government does to pay people for services, right? So it's a scary story.
It is scary. Then, you know, there's a positive side to this, I guess, a small one, Ted, is that, you know, Illinois is becoming more and more cost competitive, you know, at least if you ignore the tax issue in terms of things like housing and it's really just housing, perhaps an office space as well. But we've been writing about this too. Some of those destination cities for the past decade, particularly Nashville and Austin, Texas, nosebleed prices on real estate there. That's due for a correction. That can't be sustained. So if there's anything that Illinois has in its pocket that it can use, hopefully, if it ever straightens out its policies, it's going to be that, you know, for a major international city, which it still is, it's reasonably priced.
You know, Mark, that's a very good point. And it's a good point if we leverage it. And it's a disastrous point if we don't, because, you know, Detroit in 1970 became cheaper, and in 1980 became cheaper, and in 1990 became cheaper. But they could never leverage the fact that, you know, they had excess housing stock. It was cheaper. They could never leverage it. They lost all their people, and they lost, of course, we know what happened in Detroit. And now Chicago is no Detroit in that sense. But if you don't ever control your debts, if you can't stop the outflow of population, if you can't attract businesses, and if you continue to have crime, then it doesn't matter if you're cheap, you know, because nobody wants to be there. They know it's a negative, and it's going to go down more. So being cheap is good if you can leverage it, and being cheap is bad because if it's just, you know, on its way down in one-way track, then that's not good.
And Ted, our last topic for today is, I think it's fair to say, a blockbuster report that you did on the performance of Illinois schools. This too has gotten a lot of attention. Not as much as it should have by the Illinois press once again, but you looked in great detail at the performance of Illinois schools based on the state's own numbers. And to be charitable, you used 2019 numbers because that was the last pre-COVID year. The performance of students in Illinois schools went down in 20 and 21, but we didn't want to contaminate the conclusions and the implications by dragging in the effects of COVID into this. So I mean, this is just dismal, depressing. Tell us the numbers, some of the numbers that you found, Ted, and I encourage everyone to look at the full report because this is just devastating.
Yeah, Mark, I let me tell you the motivation real quick so people know why the hell we focused on a place like Decatur as the poster child of this education report. We originally reported, when Lori Lightfoot was bragging about the 84% graduation rate in Chicago, we heard her say that and we quickly went and, we wrote a piece about it and we looked at the actual, reading English proficiency at the high school and we found that it was only 26%. So, you got 26% of kids, only 26% of kids that can do English and reading, at grade level, and yet 84% graduate. And when we wrote about that, we got national attention for that. People were, amazed by that. Well, in preparing for a radio show to talk about some of these things for Decatur, Illinois, we looked at Decatur's numbers. And so we looked at, we went to the Illinois State Report Card. The State Board of Education provides that data. And we looked at Decatur's reading results. And what caught my eye was that only 2% of Black kids in the third grade in Decatur, and remember, third grade is the year. If you can't read in third grade, you're in big trouble the rest of school. So only 2% of Black kids could read at grade level in the Decatur's third grade. I thought it was wrong. I assumed it had to be wrong. We clicked over on the math results, and it was 1%. And we said, well, this has got to be wrong. We called the school district. And, they confirmed the numbers. They said, yes, that's what we got. And, of course, that led us to start digging into Rockford, and we dug into Elgin and Waukegan, and, we found 7% of Rockford's Black kids could read. In Decatur, just 16% of white kids could read. So it wasn't a race thing. It was an everybody thing. And, 11% of Elgin's Hispanic kids could read. So it's all over. I shouldn't say all over. It's in a lot of places like that. And, this study, though, isn't about how bad the outcomes are, because the outcomes are really bad. And we hear stories of bad outcomes, not just in Illinois, but across the country. This story is really about when we start looking at what the State Board of Education and administrators are telling parents. They sell a lot of feel good numbers, I guess, just to keep the system intact. And you've basically got an education industrial complex that runs this thing. It's very well, how do you want to say, it's protected by lots of laws. It's very well paid. Nobody wants to upset the apple cart. And I think what they just want is just to accept, hey, listen, these are the bad results we have in these schools. It's too bad. We need more money for it. We'll just keep the complex going. But nobody is really being held accountable. And they're just getting away with what are lies. And I can talk about those numbers a little bit more.
Yeah, and it's not just minority students, as you said. It's white students. The state averages are horrible as well. But we didn't cherry pick. There are some very good schools, of course, that have outperform, and some very good teachers, as we always want to thank them. They're out there. They're some of the people that I know. Some of my relatives. Thank God you're still doing what you do. But those good schools pull up the state averages as bad
That's
as
right.
they are, but overall just 89 districts had at least 60% of students who could read at grade level.
That's out of 850, Mark.
Out of 850. In 168 districts, less than 25% could read at grade level. Less than 25% in 168 districts. This is just a catastrophic failure. Do we want to educate the kids or not? We're not doing it. That's the simple answer. We are not educating these kids. They are lost. With numbers that bad, yes, this ties into crime and poverty and budget costs and everything else. They're not going to be able to perform on any basic jobs because they don't have the basic skills. We've got to do something about this. Ted, how about we'll just throw money? We got a standard answer, and taxpayers often say this too. Well, you got to put more money in the schools. That's what Illinois is going to do. That's what Illinois has been doing. Ted, that'll work, won't it?
Right. That's always a typical answer, and we got that. We presented in Rockford yesterday. Representative Sosnowski was very kind to have us up there to speak with residents of Rockford, and one of the responses by Stadelman was who's a senator up there was like, well, we need more money. Typical answer. Well, listen, Illinois spends the eighth most in the country when you add up the federal, state, and local money per student. We spend the eighth most in the country. We spend far more. We spend like $6,000 more per student than Indiana does right next door. And their results are as good or better than ours when you look at the actual outcomes. So it's not a money issue. I can tell you that. And you know, there's just one more statistic here. We looked at which states have grown their per student funding the fastest, the most in the last, last decade. Illinois, we're number one in terms of growth and spending. So we're spending lots of money. We don't need more money. We need to totally break down the system. So that's the bottom line on that.
Yeah, Illinois spends, if I got your numbers right, Ted, $16,600 per student. That includes a local, state, and federal money. After adjusted for the cost of living, that's the nation's eighth most and the highest of any state in the Midwest. Money.
That's right.
Money does not fix this. Ted, there's an irony here. Chicago, of course, has dismal test results, but they've got a ray of hope because one of the candidates for mayor, at least has been, a very outspoken champion of school choice, which is what we think is the answer. For that $16,000 per student, you give somebody a voucher or a scholarship and let them go someplace where they choose to, you're going to get a whole lot better results. That's Paul Vallis. And boy, it's going to take a lot of guts to stick to his guns on school choice. He's going to face the full wrath of Chicago Teachers Union and all the teachers unions in the state. But we just might finally have a debate about school choice. Coming out of Chicago, of all places, the belly of the beast. Why we haven't, as we've discussed before, is a mystery to me. The poll numbers are overwhelming on this. I mean, it's typically 70, 80, 85% of people in polls say they want school choice. And it cuts across party lines, racial lines, everything. Blacks want it, Hispanics, white people, everybody. But Illinois politicians don't make it. They say they're for school choice. Many of them do. But it's a low priority. It comes up maybe in passing in one of the debates or something. It's not at the top of their list. Boy, I sure hope that, I hope it becomes the Illinois mayor's race becomes a referendum on school choice. Maybe that's asking too much, but at least it'll be a significant topic for debate. Ted, you've been living the school choice battle for a long time. You took pretty much a full year up in Waukegan working with Hispanics on a school choice initiative up there. You speak Spanish. Your mother's from Ecuador. You think we got a shot at trying to make this a legitimate issue this year?
Well, I think we do have a shot at it. And Paul could be the guy. There's others talking about school choice, at the state level as well. I think we do. The more that people get to understand these facts, and a lot of this is in our report, but we have to get that out there. I want to give a couple more examples of why school choice is so important, because and why it's so hard, like you said. First of all, there's this these unions have all the power, and we've talked about that recently when we talked about Amendment 1. You know, they have the power to strike. They have these guaranteed contracts that give, you know, 3 to 5 to 7 year contracts for the unions in all the different districts. They get guaranteed raises, guaranteed benefits. They've got the constitutional protection of pensions. All the contracts are negotiated in the dark. They've got the power to strike, just one of 13 states in the country to have that power. None of our neighbors have that. So it's become a club. It's become a very insular club that's protected by those laws. Then you add this compensation. Illinois teachers are the highest paid in the Midwest and the 11th highest nationally. So, and that's for, again, for 9 months of work. So they're well compensated, and you know, they want to protect that. Then you start adding in the layer of pensions, and you start talking about the administrators. And we point that out in our piece. You know, the top administrators, you know, Laura Murray, for example, she was from Homewood Flossmoor. And again, that's a struggling district. She retired at 57. She's got a current pension of $344,000. And the estimated payouts is $9.9 million over her lifetime. The point of me bringing these kind of payouts is because there's a lot of people who don't want to upset this apple cart. School choice upsets the apple cart in a big way if it's done properly. So you're going to have a lot of entrenched bureaucracy who fight this back. And don't forget, it's the unions and the lawmakers who have worked so well together in Illinois to build up this machine they built up. This is the machine. The unions help get the lawmakers in office. The lawmakers keep the unions happy with all these benefits we're talking about. So that's going to be really hard to unwind, Mark.
Yep. It's a education industrial complex, as you called it in your report. Your report is labeled an indictment of Illinois schools. An indictment is exactly what it is. And boy, the ultimate irony and hypocrisy is that Illinois schools today are infused with these notions of white privilege and equity. Well, what's the biggest privilege that white people in prosperous suburbs have? We have the choice to send our kids to better schools if we want to, because we have the means to do that. Kids stuck in these failing school districts, their parents don't have the dough to send them someplace else. They are stuck. That is not equity. This is, as has often been said, the biggest civil rights issue of our time, and it's ignored by these hypocritical progressives that have doomed these kids to these failing systems.
Mark, you know, I always talk about this as power to the people, and I sound like a real, you know, whatever, community organizer, but this is about power to the people. Right now, when I talked about all those things we talked about, the contracts and the right to strike and all that, all the power is held by two oligopolies, let's call them, the administrators who control and run all the schools and the unions who run and control all the teachers. And together they work so hard. Sometimes they battle, but they always work together to preserve that system. And the people who have no power, and I saw this in Waukegan, man. I saw it in Waukegan, but it doesn't matter. It's Decatur, same thing. The parents have no power. They can come in and they can complain. They can complain about whatever they want to complain about. It doesn't matter because the system's not going to change. And I remember seeing a small, you know, my mom is one of these diminutive Hispanic lady, 5 feet tall. I could see, you know, but I saw some wanting to get engaged in the school, but they didn't speak English well, so they were just shoved aside. You know, they had no power. And the way to get real power for people is to take the control of the money away from the unions, away from the legislators, away from the administrators, and put it in a voucher form or in an education savings account in the hands of the people, the parents, who then find the best schools that meet their needs. And that's a real empowerment. That's, you know, I sound like a great, you know, progressive, but that's really it. It's like, put the money in the power of the people, in the hands of the people, let them choose the best schools, and take away the power from the administrators. They're failing, and they, you know, these results that we put in this report, it's just absolute failure. There's no other way to talk about it.
I mean, how can anybody, after all we've seen in the past few years, think that the government is going to run these schools properly? You have to look at, for example, how Illinois ran its unemployment compensation program during COVID, or the Afghanistan withdrawal process. They're going to run our schools. I think that needs a little reconsideration, in my opinion. Ted, that's all I got. I know you get worked up about the schools thing. You got anything else to add?
No, I think that's it. You know, just the example of Decatur, you know, they got 8,400 kids. And, you know, every year that they can't figure this out, you have about, whatever, 600 kids, 700 kids come out. They're not ready for the workforce. They're not ready for college. Decatur is a city that's lost a quarter of its population since 1980, and it's struggling. And so is Rockford, and so is Peoria. They're all struggling. And what they need is, if they want to rebuild and grow again, they need a great workforce that's ready for this century. And that's not what's happening. And we're setting them up for failure. And so we need to change the model. If we want to have a great Illinois again, we got to give those kids a chance. And school choice doesn't solve everything, but it certainly is a step in the right direction. It's certainly a freedom movement, if you will.
On those cheery notes, we're going to sign off. We actually really do make an effort to find positive stories. If you got any, slap them up in a comment on any of our stories. We'll look into them, and criticisms of any of our stories, we've got a wide open comment board. As long as you keep the language clean, we're going to look at them. We're going to respond to them, and that's why we're here. Talk to you next week on The Dialogue from Wire Points.